This is Aspire, Arch Street Public Radio, broadcasting interviews from our Innovate podcast series.
My name is Robert Rim, Managing Editor for Arch Street Press. I'll be your host today. Anna Pantilic is the Director of Business and Partnership Development at Fundación Capital, working to promote economic citizenship for low-income and vulnerable people throughout the world. She holds a PhD in political science from the University of Belgrade, an MA in international relations, and a BS in communications, both from Boston University. An enthusiastic proponent of the notion that disruptive ideas change the world, Anna has spent the last few years working with Fundación Capital in Bogotá, Colombia, as leader of the award-winning Lista initiative. She's a social policy and communication consultant for the Center for Rural Development and Applied Learning, founder of Sustainable Habits for Sustainable Development Project, and an affiliated researcher with the Center for Environmental Policy and Sustainable Development in her native Serbia. Anna, good to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Robert.
How did your upbringing, splitting time between Serbia and the U.S., inspire you to be a world traveler and perhaps even inform your career arc?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It was something that never really came as a planned thing. I would say that my parents, you know, obviously had a very international perspective on the world. But in our case, a lot of the travels that we did when my sister and myself were young between the United States and Serbia was a result of economic and political difficulties happening in the former Yugoslavia, in today's Serbia. And so we were lucky enough that we had the opportunity to come to the United States to do our studies. And we just moved back and forth, really, a few years here, a few years there. And that perspective on two completely different worlds was something that absolutely informed my decision to work in international development. It's something that inspired this dichotomous relationship in my mind between these different worlds that I was inhabiting. And it gave me a sensitivity to the world around me and the people surrounding me. And it was difficult to accept some of the injustices and inequalities that I was seeing around me, and really inspired me to pursue the work that I'm doing. And I would say that from that early experience, I continue to travel, and I've had the immense pleasure of seeing many parts of the world, and seeing really how people live, how cultures are structured, and how societies are functioning in areas where there's high levels of economic development, and in others where there's political strife and certainly poverty. And so realizing and embracing the fact that there's really a lot of power in every individual is something that was really inspiring to me to see. And I was particularly impressed when I was getting ready to move to Colombia that it's a country where perhaps it has a negative reputation, but it's a country that's actually always listed as in the top 10 of the happiest nations in the world. And that was something that was really inspiring to me, that despite all of its many political challenges and security issues, in fact, it has really warm and happy people. And that was something that I found to be really exciting, to have the opportunity to live there and work there. And it's something that I think one doesn't really often get the opportunity to put themselves in the shoes of the other. And that to me was really important. So I would say that that background and upbringing was really what shaped and molded my perspective on life. Mm.
And in prior interviews, you've talked about your own experiences with informal economies. Were these experiences formative to your own career? Was a personal point of reference that you drew on once you were already on the path?
Yeah, definitely. I would say that experiences in the informal economy are really globally representative. There's a lot of informal market activities that are happening, and it's a lot of the way in which people survive on a daily basis. The ability for people to succeed with so little resources is very impressive. And in fact, in the world of social enterprise, they say that having too much money can actually kill a business idea. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's better to have less resources, to be scrappy, to be inventive, to be thinking on your feet and really trying to make it until tomorrow. That's where some of the best ideas really come through. And while I think obviously there's very important elements to formality, that's not really the way that much of the world works. And when you can embrace the two sides and try to seek that balance, I think you can achieve a lot of really great things. And by Embracing that entrepreneurial spirit, we have some of the most interesting new designs and inventions that are coming up that really address society's daily issues and challenges, and particularly at that local level. When those solutions come as a response to somebody solving their own needs of today, that's where I think the best innovations can come from.
And in your own experience, are politicians and governments generally supportive of informal economies?
I think you'd be surprised by how open they can be to new opportunities. I think it's obviously formality is something that's very important within the confines of the traditional structures of government. But more and more, there is this understanding that there should be a balance between the two. With formality, especially for small businesses, comes some sense of security and structure that governments can provide. But the systems maybe right now don't really allow for such simplified integration. And at times, there's a lack of trust really between the private enterprises, particularly small and informal ones in the state. And there's not always the guarantee that the state won't come and intervene and perhaps overtax. They call it the guillotine tax that ends businesses.
Yes.
So I think that there's a lot more understanding that we see nowadays with politicians, and you can see also with the integration of innovation as the core part of the strategic direction of many governments, where they're really trying to find ways that meet their own needs and not implement systems and policies that look good in theory and on paper, but that really reflect the needs of their citizens.
And is part of your work actually devoted to enhancing that trust between governments and informal economies?
Absolutely. I mean, we as Fundación Capital spend a lot of time working with national governments because for us, addressing the challenges of social inequality really require the participation of everyone. So we work with the private sector, particularly with financial institutions, and we work a lot with national governments and more particularly with their ministries of social development, with their central banks, ministries of economy, etc., trying to help them improve regulations and policies that are more conducive to the needs of low-income families and communities. Now, that's not to say that governments haven't been doing this for a long time. They're certainly experts at this. But sometimes working with an organization like ours, we're able to inject a little bit more of innovation and flexibility, take some risks, take on some pilots. And we've had some support from wonderful funders that have helped us and allowed us to do this. And so working together, I think we've been able to come up with some solutions that have helped link low-income people more directly with national governments, particularly through cash transfer programs and other initiatives that governments have been leading.
And some of these are international funders, aren't they?
Yeah, so one of our earliest funders was the Ford Foundation, and they've been amazing. We've been working with United Nations International Fund for Agricultural Development, Citi Foundation, more recently with the Skoll Foundation, and USAID is a recent funder of ours, as well as some smaller institutions. And so it's really been a plethora of different funders that we've been working with. But governments themselves have also been supporting our work through some direct contracts, as have the private sector. So more and more, we're seeing that there is this interest from all parts to really participate and to create some innovative solutions that can be applied at scale to address some of the challenges of poverty, inequality, and exclusion.
And you have several degrees from different countries, including a PhD from Belgrade. What are some of the differences you see in how these countries approach education, perhaps in terms of preparing someone for the business world?
Yeah, I mean, I think every institution is different. I've studied predominantly in Serbia and the United States, and I would say that in the United States, a lot of the academic institutions are really focused on practice and applied knowledge, whereas in Serbia, there's been a lot more focus on the theory. And I would say that my experience, especially in the formative years of elementary school, was slightly stronger on science and mathematics and some of the hard sciences. Whereas in the United States, there was a lot more focus on the practical application, the analytical thinking. And actually, my high school program was the International Baccalaureate program. So that might not be the most representative of a typical U.S. high school education because that really is a very international approach, and it's a program that exists throughout the world. But to me, what was important about that experience was that it's not about sort of regurgitating information that's memorized, but really thinking through and clearly argumenting why you believe something and why you think that something should be implemented, that I found really useful later on in my life. And I would say that for my experience in Serbia, I mean, it was really quite a challenge for me actually to go back to writing in Serbian after not having used the language that way in a while. But it is interesting to see how some of these ideas that I had seen throughout Latin America and in the United States could then be applied to Serbia and vice versa. So I would say that if you ever have the opportunity to do more of an international degree, it's really a great way to challenge yourself to think differently and to understand the local systems in that way that are projected through the educational system. So, to me, it was really a great opportunity to do both. And of course, as soon as you finish one degree, you're thinking, what else can I do? And
Indeed, yes.
yeah.
And you mentioned bridging theory and practice. Would it be fair to say that social entrepreneurship is one of the hearts of that concept?
I think today's how we're seeing social entrepreneurship today, absolutely. I think that more and more social entrepreneurs are integrating data and research and are learning from each other and are sharing experiences with each other. I think there's a strong push for evidence-based decision making. And I think that from academia as well, there's that understanding that the research can't just be sort of done from the same perspective as one would have in the laboratory, especially when you're working in the social sciences. It's really important to understand the context in which research is being performed. And so academics are actually adapting to local needs and the realities of what it's like to do research in the field in the social sciences. And so I would say that absolutely in social entrepreneurship, we are seeing that there is that blend of theory and practice. And what that has done actually is, I think, facilitate knowledge exchange and bringing some new and different ideas to regions. And so we see examples of really innovative work in mobile money in Africa, coming to Latin America and other regions, whereas conversely, some of the social policies, particularly the conditional cash transfer programs that originated from Latin America, now being dispersed throughout the world. And if it hadn't been for that research and that theoretical understanding behind those social policies, we wouldn't have been able to expand it that way. So I say that I think the same is true in business as it is for policy, that there is that blend, and we're going to be seeing more of that in the future.
And along those lines, what does the phrase economic citizenship mean to you?
You know, economic citizenship for us, it's really a reflection of the sentiment of being a citizen, of feeling connected to the world around you, to your community, feeling that you have a voice and that you are a part of that community. And the economic aspect of it is really understanding that people need to have that ability to sustain themselves. You know, if you think about the challenges of poverty, I mean, they're immense, right? There's so many different ways that one can address it, from health to education to infrastructure, security. There's a lot of elements to it. But the tie that binds all of those is finance, really, is the financial vulnerability that comes with living in poverty. Because if you have money, you can purchase health, right? You can purchase education. You can pay for more expensive transportation services. And if you don't, then, you know, then none of those improvements will really help. So for us, we really see finance as being the basis that joins all of those elements together. And so when somebody is an economic citizen, that means that they're empowered, that means that they're recognized by their community, that means that they can be a participant in the market, in their local economy, that they can contribute and that they can purchase and that they can really, you know, move themselves out of poverty by having some sort of economic activity that will enable them to have that security and decrease the financial vulnerability that is associated with poverty. So for us, it's a way of encapsulating that notion of empowerment, of strength, of participation, of having your voice heard, that defines economic citizenship to us.
Which directly leads to social stability, doesn't it?
Exactly.
And going back to Fundación Capital, what led you to Colombia and to that organization?
I had done some research on some of the issues that we work on during my master's program, and I had always been drawn to the region because I saw a lot of parallels between Latin America and my native country, Serbia. And I saw an ad posted for the organization, and I thought, I can really do something with them. At the time, they were looking for somebody with a bit more experience and some contacts that I didn't really have, but I thought, why not apply? You never know. So I took that chance and I applied, and we had a great first interview. And I remember my boss, the founder of the organization, Yves Mouri, telling me, what's the worst that can happen? You come here, you think we're a bunch of crazy people, and you don't like it, and you go home. What's the worst that can happen? You had a 2 month vacation in Colombia, there you go. It's an experience and a story to tell at parties. But what if you come here and you find out that our kind of crazy is your kind of crazy? Then you can stay. So, I really found a home for myself with the organization. I've been with them for 5 years now. And I've accompanied a lot of different processes and growth, helped us expand into Africa, growing our digital solutions department. We received the Skoll Award for social entrepreneurship, and that has propelled us forward and given us a platform and visibility. And it's been an amazing experience. And at the time, we were 10 people. Today, we're 90. We're in 14 different countries, and the staff is an incredible group of people who are equally diverse as myself. We have 22 different nationalities, 9 different maternal languages, and a whole lot of others. And it's just a great group of passionate people who have the energy, the insight, the drive, and really the creativity that's needed for working in social entrepreneurship. So it's a fantastic organization, and it was a clear example of an opportunity that I took that has brought me some wonderful returns. And so that's why I'm such a huge proponent of people really taking that leap of faith, because in my case, it's really worked out for me.
And the way you just described the organization, it's surely participatory from the inside out. And so, looking outside, how has the participatory design model informed Fundación Capital's approach to developing economic solutions?
We never planned to grow and become a large nonprofit organization like a traditional standard charity. We've always sought to work like a social enterprise, to be agile, and to bring some of the innovation that's needed for systems change. And to change systems, you really need to work with the systems. So we work with the private and the public sectors, and we understand that we really can't do anything on our own. And there are existing systems and infrastructure that we don't want to compete with, but we want to add value to. So every country where we work, we only begin working there if we see an opportunity to do some good. And so we partner with national governments in every country that we work with, and we establish memorandums of understanding, and we define what areas we could work on together. And the same with the financial institutions. We add value to the work that they do, but don't try to supersede that and do something on our own. It's really about embedding some innovation and embedding some processes into their work. And it's participatory in multiple senses, right? It's not just about working with those institutions, but it's also about translating from the participants themselves, the end users, the people who are living in poverty, and understanding their needs that informs all of our decisions and our designs. So we do a lot of needs assessments and research in the field. We spend a lot of time trying to understand the day-to-day challenges of living in poverty and surviving, and the systems that people can access. So whether that's financial systems or social protection, or even the private market, it's about understanding what's available. It's about injecting new things that could be available, particularly when it comes to technology. And it's not about designing from the desk, from an office, but really designing alongside, together with co-creating, with all of our partners from the top to the bottom to the top, however you want to define it. I don't even like thinking about it in such a vertical way, but it's really about the circle and about the system and all of the participants. So when you take into consideration everybody's needs, then you can find that golden balance that will make change happen.
And co-creating is so crucial, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, without that, there's really no sense in doing anything involved in social enterprise. Sometimes, from books or from short visits, one can think that something would be a good product or would be a good service to people. But when you design it initially and you go and try and implement it, you will sometimes find that you know you're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, and that simply doesn't work. And so that's why a lot of these processes that are related to lean and agile development, minimum viable products, all of those things that you learn about around social enterprise, particularly when you start designing with some of these quick, fast, iterative processes, that's when you can see what works and what doesn't work. And people will sometimes not be able to tell you, you know, I need this particular thing, but you can start to infer from some of their needs and make some suggestions. Could it be this? Could it be that? And with this iterative process of different options, that's when you can come up with a few different potential solutions. So in our case, when we had designed a tablet-based app for providing financial education and training, that wasn't something that would come off the top of somebody's head as this is going to be a solution that could work. It was something that came out as a result of needs assessments, co-creation in terms of designing the contents, but it's not something that would have come up on its own just from thinking about the problem and saying, oh, this is the perfect solution. You really have to go out and test it and make sure that it's going to work before you even start investing money into it.
This episode of Innovate is brought to you by 19th Street Press and Queen of Angels, the debut novel from David Castro. Queen of Angels contrasts Shakespeare with gritty, profane 70s New York. Not only is the novel a compelling exploration of young love, it's a gripping piece of storytelling, says Publishers Weekly. Queen of Angels by David Castro from 19th Street Press.
Tell us about the Lista initiative.
So Fundación Capital had been working for a while on financial inclusion. And financial inclusion really requires this three-pronged approach. It requires working with policy and regulation, working with the national governments. It requires working with the supply and with financial institutions, and then, of course, with the demand. And on that demand side, that involves strengthening the skills and abilities of people living in poverty and empowering them to really access and use the formal financial system. For us, it was really important to promote savings as that first step. And when people try to build their assets and exit poverty, it doesn't start with credit and loans. It starts with savings, because that's where you start to build behavior. And we had a lot of experience providing financial education and training to people through traditional modalities, from face-to-face in-person trainings, but also some slightly less traditional using mass media, radio programs, street theater, and other sort of more traditionally used methodologies, some of which are more innovative, but nothing quite as dramatic as what we were proposing. We realized that when we're working with national governments who have programs that reach multiple millions of people, it's impossible to reach economies of scale with the programs that you design. So we designed and developed a tablet-based app that was really designed from the contents to the user experience for a low-income person living in rural areas, particularly adults. And that was our solution to the challenge that we were facing of scaling up this training.
So in Latin America, for example, how has technology literally helped advance the concept of financial education?
Technology is really just it's a platform that we use to reach the people, and it's a way of multiplying that human capacity and ability, right? So instead of having somebody go door to door and provide this empowerment and training, what you can do is through an application, you basically have a virtual professor, but then you also have a virtual peer mentor, because there's videos that are shot locally of people who are like the participants themselves, who will then tell their story about how they succeeded through savings, how they were able to build and start a business, and what they were able to achieve. And this sense of empowerment, and sense that, you know, I can do it, I did it, you also can do it, you'll do it. That's something that sometimes can't be transmitted by a trainer, and it can be transmitted through technology. But there's other opportunities there too. When we're seeing mobile money expand more and more and fintech opportunities, that's where we start to see the ability to integrate these trainings directly with financial products and services, where you can then be able to say, okay, now I do want to start saving, and then you make a savings commitment in your account. Or you're able to start learning how to use a mobile wallet, so then you can actually start using it to facilitate your payments in the future. And there's a lot more that you can do with that, and that's what big data is allowing us to do. And we don't see too much of that from the fintech sector yet within this population, but I think we're going to be seeing more and more of it. I mean, it's a booming industry, and there's a massive market there, and we're going to see a lot more of that integration of technology, and especially financial technology, I think, is a tool for helping people exit poverty. And of course, it won't be the only thing that's necessary. We don't never advocate the magic bullets, because there's never one thing that will help. There's never the one thing that will change somebody's life, but it's an important step. And technology allows us a lot more opportunity than we've ever been able to dream before.
And we talked at the beginning about being receptive to change. How has Fundación Capital's mission evolved since your start with the organization?
When we started, we were really focused on the Latin American region. We saw a lot of opportunities there. We saw a lot of comparisons between the similarities, rather, between the different countries. And when we started to grow, we also began to engage in South-South cooperation and exchanges. And we were seeing some interesting innovations coming out of the global South and in Africa and Asia that we really wanted to apply to the countries that we were working in and with. And so our mission has really expanded beyond the confines of that region to start working in other geographic areas. So that's one area where I would say that we've shifted and grown. Another area is in that digital transformation space, and I would say that the integration of digital solutions has been of growing importance to the organization over the last 6 or 7 years. And it's something that we see as an important investment for us to understand how we can be players in that, but also how we can work with other partners and add value to what they're already doing. So I would say that those are the big areas where there've been some changes for us.
And speaking of other geographical areas, along with your work at Fundación Capital, you also consult rather for the Center for Rural Development and Applied Learning. Tell us about that, where it is, and your work with them.
Yeah, so the center is based in a small village in about an hour north of Belgrade. It's actually a team of some wonderful international experts that I was working with about I would say 6 or 7 years ago through this course on sustainability. And Roger Bald, he is the founder of this center, was working with a friend of mine, Igor Yezdimirovich, and the two of them started concocting this idea of setting up a center that would allow students and youth activists from throughout Europe, and predominantly, but also internationally, to come to Serbia and learn about rural development through actual application. So they got some funders together and established the center, built this rebuilt rather this traditional Serbian house, and brought in some amazing architects and sustainability experts from throughout Europe to Serbia, and are putting together different courses for youth and allowing, especially researchers, the opportunity to learn more about organic farming practices, about local community development, and learn from global experts as well as from their own applied research when it's applied directly in the context of Serbia. It's not an easy thing to achieve, I think, because in a country like Serbia, there's a lot of administrative barriers and procedures that one has to face and overcome. But there's, again, something about the scrappy nature and attitude of our people that, to me, is fascinating. And Igor, has been running a nonprofit organization in Serbia and doing amazing things with youth volunteers for a long time, especially in the area of the environment. And it's incredible to me to see so much energy coming from people. It's when you have almost a generation that's grown up in a post-war space with very little economic opportunities, all you hear about is brain drain and unemployment. And yet here are some people coming together and creating new jobs and new opportunities and inspiring people from Serbia to learn about some new and sustainable environmental practices. And so it's really wonderful to think that my country could really have an important voice in that space and can really add to that research as well.
And so many young people find these examples inspiring. What advice would you have for those students, those people just graduating from college, perhaps graduate students, even those beginning their careers, who may be interested in exploring education and careers beyond the United States?
You know, I would say that one of the first things is if they have the opportunity, even while they're in school, to do some internships, to study a foreign language, to take the opportunity to travel, to try and go against the grain and maybe not spend their spring breaks or their summers, with friends sort of at a relaxing beach destination. But maybe it can be a different country. Maybe it can be the opportunity to interact with the local culture. You can volunteer. You can do some sort of a practical internship in a foreign country, or just try to get to know some people from different backgrounds and hear their story and understand where they come from. And, maybe you can get a chance to even visit them in their home countries. And this will really, I think, give you a better sense of the world around you. And, you know, I'm not naive to assume that everyone has that facility to just jump on a plane and go somewhere else. I know that there's student loans and financially it can be very difficult to travel. But I remember, growing up, I spent a lot of years living in Florida, and I had friends who would tell me, wow, you're so lucky. You get to travel. You get to go to Europe. Isn't that amazing? And I thought to myself, my I'm living with my grandparents in a rented apartment. We don't own a home. We don't own a fancy car. We don't have really nice fancy clothes. These are the decisions that we made. You know, I think you don't have to be rich to travel. There's so many ways to participate and to get to see the world around you that don't cost money, that don't cost a lot of money at least. And there's lots of ways now, especially with remote working, where you can work from abroad and even combine the two. So if it's important to you, you will always find a way to make it work. And I think once you start traveling and once you start seeing the world, you'll really learn to appreciate more of the things that you have, and hopefully also become much more involved in your community, wherever that may be, whether it be in the United States or abroad. It's just about listening and keeping your eyes open to those opportunities and really taking that leap of faith whenever you can.
And on that note, Anna, with local cultures, with different backgrounds, with other languages, with community involvement, such a vital message for young people today. Anna, again, it's so good to have you with us today, and we wish you all the best with your work.
Thank you so much, Robert. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us today. Our library of interviews and a range of further resources are available at our website, innovatepodcast.org. Aspire and Innovate are produced in partnership with Ashoka, Innovators for the Public, the Kellogg Fellows Leadership Alliance, the Philadelphia Social Innovations Journal, and by Arch Street Press. For PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.